Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, in other words, to address real issues rather than defending ideological positions. Well, America's healthcare system is seriously ill. And maybe instead of seeing a doctor, we need to see a paradox. So here are some paradoxical irony supplements to munch on. Did you know that the U.S. spends more on healthcare as a share of the economy, nearly twice as much as the average industrial country, yet has the lowest life expectancy and highest suicide rate among the 11 OECD countries, that is, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Did you know the U.S. has the highest chronic disease burden and an obesity rate that's two times higher than the OECD average? Did you know that Americans had fewer physician visits than peers in most countries, which may be related to a low supply of physicians in the U.S.? And did you know, compared to peer nations, the U.S. has among the highest number of hospitalizations from preventable causes and the highest rate of avoidable deaths? Well, do the math and do the aftermath, because the chronic illness of our healthcare system impacts all segments of our society and the economy. And perhaps the greatest negative impact is on people of color. Compared to whites, they're more likely to be uninsured, face discrimination that creates barriers to care, and they are more likely to suffer from preventable health conditions and early death. Now, of course, this is situations even more acute during this COVID era. Our guest this week is Dr. Susan Rogers. She's director of physicians for our national healthcare program. And as an African-American and a medical doctor, she has seen firsthand how the healthcare for people of color can be secondhand and thirdhand. Now, this not only has to do with healthcare delivery, but also prevention, nutrition, and other factors that can negatively impact health. Dr. Rogers has recently retired from Stroger Hospital of Cook County in Illinois, but she continues as a volunteer, attending hospitalist and internist there. While there, she was co-director of medical student programs for the Department of Medicine, and she received numerous teaching awards from medical students and residents. She is also an assistant professor of medicine at Rush University, where she continues to be an active member of the Committee of Admissions. She got her medical degree from the University of Illinois College of Medicine, completed her residency at Cook County Hospital, where she served an additional year as the chief resident. She's a national board member of Physicians for a National Health Program, now director, and past and co-president of Healthcare for All of Illinois. So welcome, Dr. Rogers.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show today. I've been looking forward to this.
Me too, because I think this is a very important issue. As I mentioned in the introduction, we already have a medical crisis now that's compounded by COVID. So let's begin by focusing on the impact these crises are having on the African-American community in other communities of color and poverty.
Well, one of the biggest issues that we have with our medical care system here in the United States is it is a profit-driven system, so that it is there to make money, not necessarily to take care of people. So if you look at the minority community, the Black community, which has been economically disadvantaged, you know, for years, and then you have a system that is driven by profit, of course this group is going to be disenfranchised. And the coupling of health insurance from your employer is really part of the big issue, because when you think about it, if you have to be working to be able to get health insurance, what happens when you become too ill to work? Then you can't work anymore. You can't pay for your health insurance. So now you're uninsured at the time that you need it. And if you look at what has happened with COVID, is that there have been inequities all along that have never been addressed. And so it surprised me how people, the media, seem to be so shocked that the African-American community was so devastated by this disease. I mean, many of us did not have private health insurance. The bulk of essential workers, the persons who had to go to work and had close interactions with the people that they worked with, or the people that came to those businesses. We're talking about the food industry, the retail industry, the meatpacking industry, transportation, all of that. It put them at a disadvantage. And then when you add, too, that they may have already had pre-existing conditions for all the other reasons that they have inequities, they have poor housing, all of that, it was just a perfect storm. And so it isn't surprising that, unfortunately, this community has been the most impacted by COVID.
Well, you know, I think you also pointed out the elephant and the donkey in the living room, because, frankly, both political parties seem to be committed to our medical system as a for-profit system. And I think that you hit it right on the head, that when money becomes the most important thing, then everything else kind of falls by the wayside.
Well, that's exactly what is going on here. And part of the problem is the lobbyists and campaign donors that fund Congress. And because unless we get campaign reform, you're going to have politicians who are dependent on people who can write big checks to them. And that's actually who they end up representing, rather than the people in their districts that they should be representing, rather than their constituents. So that we have a system that is not made to take care of everybody. Poor people have never been the patients that people wanted to treat, because they did not get reimbursed as much. Even if you look at our system of Medicaid, which was created to help take care and to provide access to care for people who did not have the financial means to do so. They were below the poverty levels, whatever the criteria varied among state to state. But the reimbursements were so low that many providers chose not to see Medicaid patients. So this whole thing about being insured does not necessarily give you access to care. Even if you have private insurance, many insurers now have such large deductibles, and a large deductible is $1,500 to $3,500 or more, that you have to come out of pocket and pay before your private insurance starts to cover your expenses. Most people don't have that. So they choose to not access care, to not go to the doctor, because they can't incur those costs. And so having an insurance card does not necessarily mean that your insurance will cover you, that your insurance will help you. I like the metaphor of it's like having that dream car in your garage, but they didn't give you the keys, so you can't use it.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I have to confess that my wife and I, we've had health insurance over the years, and we let it go a couple of times because, first of all, we're healthy. We don't use a lot of medical, we fortunately don't need a lot of medical care. You know, and so we've had to let it go because we started realizing that we're paying alternative physicians for our medical care that aren't covered by the regular insurance. And of course, because that's a for-profit business like the healthcare industry, you know, they're paying people to deny claims, so to speak, or to make sure that they only pay out a certain amount. So it's not really a service given to people. And, you know, you mentioned something about, you know, as being a physician these days and the changes that have taken place, you know, in the decades that, you know, since you got your degree. I want to go back a little bit and find out a little bit more about your own background, how you found your calling to be an MD, and then a little bit about your education and, going to various different schools, and then also how being a physician has changed in the time since you first began to practice.
Yes, well, being a physician has changed a lot, but I guess my journey started back. I remember my favorite teacher in high school was my freshman biology teacher, and that's where I got very interested in biology, and that sparked my interest in going into medicine, so that when I went away to college as a freshman, I was a biology major. Now, I left a community here in Chicago that was quite diversified and integrated, and I went to a school in Colorado that a friend suggested, and at the time I felt, well, if I don't go to Colorado, I'll never go. At the time, mm-hmm. The world was nowhere near as small as it is now. And so I went to Colorado. I was the only black biology major there. It was a school that was very, very wealthy. I had no idea. Back then, nobody visited schools. You just sort of, you know, decided to do it and to go wherever. And it was not a very welcoming place at all. It was, the wealth there was, I'm not talking about doctor lawyer wealth. It was, you know, corporate wealth. It was wealth that I had no idea about. And I was not welcomed. I was not encouraged. And so after 2 years, I left. I then went to a historically black college, and I remained a biology major there. But then there was an illness in the family, and so I stayed home, and I ended up going to a commuter school here in Chicago, and I was fortunate to able still get my degree in 4 years. But that also got me involved in a group of minority students that were all applying to medical schools. So it really helped me in the journey and just the whole process of applying. And so I went to the University of Illinois in Chicago so that I could still stay in the city. And while I was there, I knew I wanted to train at Stroger Hospital of Cook County. Now, Cook County had a reputation back then that was phenomenal. I think then, and this was in the late 70s, actually, the mid-70s. I'm older than I think. But Cook County Hospital.
You're only as old as you think. That's a good point.
Yeah. We're as old as you feel. But Cook County had a reputation of over half the practicing physicians in the country had at one time gone through the hallways of Cook County. And there were very many firsts that were done. But it was a safety net hospital. It was a government-run hospital. It was mostly black patients. And that's where I wanted to go. And that was my goal. I wanted to be a physician to take care of black patients. And when I started there, it was very similar to functioning in a single-payer system. At the time, there was no one paid for anything. You could have come in with money in your pocket, and they would have had no way to write up a bill for you to even pay, or if you were insured, for them to bill your insurance. But what I was able to do was you would talk to patients, you would decide what they needed. The medications were free, so they would get the medications that they needed. If they needed surgeries, if they needed procedures, it was all done. There was no question about paying for it. It was the ideal way to be a physician. And it was also an ideal way to develop relationships with my patients. And I just loved it. I loved being a clinician. I loved taking care of people. And I felt very appreciated there, that I was there doing that for them. And it was a fabulous experience. I did leave a little for a little while after my training, but I did return because I still wanted to come back to Cook County and take care of those patients. Now, as time has gone on, the financing of medical care has changed so that we now had to have co-pays for medications, and now that Medicaid has expanded and there had to be networks, so it became even more difficult to pay for patients who had Medicaid, because if they weren't in our network, they would be billed. So all the absurdities and the administrative obstacles that other physicians in private healthcare systems were faced with, we were now facing at Cook County. And then with the COVID, it became even more difficult because we were a safety net hospital. So that's my journey. I've seen how the administrative burden on physicians, and this administrative burden, too, has nothing to do with providing health care. It has to do with getting insurance companies data so that they can deny the care that your patient needs. It can tell them that, no, they are in the wrong network. No, we won't cover this particular drug. So the administrative burden that's placed on physicians and the administrative obstacles that get placed in front of us by these insurance companies have really hindered care. And it's an incredible industry. If you look at a large institution like Duke Hospital, Duke has actually three hospitals, but there are two times as many people working in billing as there are nurses taking care of patients. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the hospital for? It's supposed to be to provide care, but what it's doing is providing jobs for billers. So yeah, the whole focus has changed.
Wow. Well, that's stark. We're going to have to take a little break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes after our commercial breaks. We'll be back with Dr. Susan Rogers talking about medicine in the COVID era, particularly with people of color. Steve Behrman, back shortly.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. At the Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. There is this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to Black and brown people. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. There's something better waiting for us, something that feels more like freedom. Truth can inspire change. Please learn more at EJI.org.
Well, you know, these times have been described as apocalyptic times, and really what the meaning of apocalypse is the lifting of the veils. And, you know, we're lifting the veils on some very kind of toxic contradictions and ironies. And as our guest today, Dr. Susan Rogers, just pointed out, you know, there are more people working in the billing department than in the actual nursing department giving care, and the purpose of the billing department. And as you, I'm paraphrasing you, and I know you didn't say it cynically, you said it in actuality, is to deny care, is to find the reasons why the insurance company doesn't have to pay. So now, in the light or dark of this medical infrastructure that we've had that has the inertia of wanting to continue the way it is. The issue of universal health care, it's been on the table and off the table since the Clinton administration. What are the prospects now, now that you've taken that? We could talk a little bit more about physicians as advocates for universal health care. That's something I think has changed. But what are the prospects for universal health care now, and any signs, any hopeful signs that you see?
Well, I think over time, more and more people are more supportive of single payer or Medicare for all than they have been, and the numbers are steadily increasing. In fact, now we have a majority of physicians that support single payer health care. One of the things that I think has greatly impacted the public is that so many more people are unable to afford their insurance. And if you look at the leading causes of bankruptcies, it's not because people buy too big a car or too big a screen TV, but it's medical bills. It's the leading cause of bankruptcy is medical bills. And this is why people often do not go to access medical care, because they are afraid of these bills. And with COVID now, more and more people have lost their insurance because their jobs are no longer there. They may have depleted all of their savings. So now they cannot afford health care at all. So we've got more and more people now who may have been doing fine before with their private health insurance now cannot access care.
Well, you know, and the need is there for sure,
Yes, and I think that this is becoming more and more obvious to people, this precarious relationship with their employer. Because when you think about, and, you know, the private insurance industry has come up with a lot of little tricks to make you believe that their insurance is there to help you and all of that. But like I mentioned before, they are there to deny your care or to not pay for a particular medicine that you need. So that it becomes more and more obvious to people who need care to find the difficulties in accessing that care. And the networks, too, become, it becomes impossible for you to even figure out who you can go see, who your doctor can refer you to, what can you get, what is covered and what isn't. And people talk about, the insurance companies want to emphasize this choice thing. And I don't know this choice thing that they're talking about, because when you think about it, you want a choice of where you can go for your care, who you can go to for your care, where, what drugstore you can go to get your prescriptions filled. You don't care about whether it's Cigna or Aetna or Blue Cross. That's not important. What's the choices you want to make is where you get your care and who provides that care for you. Because if it's, if that relationship is tied to your job, of which you're not always in control of, your employer can change the company that you get your health insurance through. So the choices you had last year, you may not have this year. So that you're not in control of anything when it's through your employer and when it's through another company. Whereas with a single payer system, you can go anywhere and you can see anybody. If you're on vacation in another state, your single payer covers you. And that's the beauty of traditional Medicare, too, is that you can go wherever you want in the country and receive your care. Whereas with private insurance companies, you can't. It's not necessarily provided except in an emergency.
You know,
so all of these... All of these choices that the marketing industry has tried to make people believe that they want are totally unnecessary. The choice you want is where you go and who takes care of you.
Well, don't you think that there's actually fewer fewer people who have jobs now, or given the fact that the unions are, have a lot less power than they used to, there's actually fewer places where the employer is actually covering that, and there's more people who are doing gig work, etc. So if you happen to be driving for Uber or Lyft or something like that, Where's your health insurance there? You have to pay for it yourself. And so many of these other full-time jobs, because the employers don't want the burden either, I'm sure that makes sense that employers would say, you know what, we would love to see this universal health care, and that takes us off the hook. And all of a sudden, it's something that they're not dealing with. Do you think that employers would like to see this universal health care idea?
Some of them would. Remember, too, though, that employers get a tax benefit from paying for health insurance. And this started back in World War II, when during the war, wages were frozen, but factories still needed people to work for them to provide goods for the war. And so what they did was, that was when Blue Cross actually started this whole health insurance industry. And so one of the ways they did this was they gave employers tax benefits for paying for health insurance premiums. And so that condition has persisted. And when you have a large company like GM who gets a phenomenal tax benefit, it may be partially to their interest to pay for that. But the majority of companies would rather your health insurance be covered by someone else, because then they know you're totally covered. You won't come to work sick and get everybody else sick because you can't afford to take a few hours to go to the doctor and get something for whatever it is that's ailing you. So it would allow them to, it would also free up money to put into salaries versus paying healthcare premiums. So it would be a win-win. The company may be paying the same amount of dollars, but the worker would be getting more money in their pocket along with having health insurance. So it really is a win-win solution for employers and employees.
And of course, again, it all of this has to be done above and beyond the influence, the money influence of the medical industry and insurance industry. Now, you know, when I was a kid, we were poor. I grew up in a housing project, and yet we had a family doctor who made house calls with the ubiquitous little black case that doctors carry in those days.
Mm-hmm.
People knew they were a doctor, you know. And so, that was, at that point, 50 years ago, doctors were self-employed. I don't want to call them entrepreneurs because I don't think that they were out for profit that way, but they were out to, to make a decent living as a professional and do good work like you were doing, at Cook County. So over this period of time, the physicians that I've spoken to, and a number of them have simply quit. How has that impacted, spiritually and emotionally, this thing of I am a physician? Can you say something about that?
Well, what has happened... When I graduated from medical school, I didn't even know what a hospital administrator was. It wasn't really an industry that people talked about. I don't think I knew anybody in college who was a health administration major. They may have been business administration majors or things like that, but I never knew what a hospital administrator was. I knew there was somebody there who made sure that the lights stayed on and that there were always paper towels, but I didn't know what they did. But after I graduated, it just grew astronomically, and that whole industry developed. And that's when there began a change from doctors going into private practice, because I was asked by a lot of people, are you going to open up your own practice, to versus going with a group. Nowadays, over 70% of physicians are part of a group. They are employed doctors, versus back then, most of them were their own doctors, or it may have been a small group in an office. But now, they have become, unfortunately, physicians, we've become no more important than the person that answers the phone, regardless of our degree of training. And that what has happened is that we become expendable. I mean, why else during a pandemic would doctors be laid off? And that's because the groups that employ them didn't make enough. They weren't making money, even though there was a need for those physicians to stay there. So it's become this very perverse medical industrial complex that the bottom line is what is more important than taking care of patients. And it has just usurped the autonomy that physicians used to have. And that has been lost. And not only have physicians lost, patients have lost. It's really the worst for patients now.
You know, I had an experience in the 1970s. You know, we had a family doctor. My dad had a heart condition. And when he moved to, my parents moved to Washington, D.C. from New York, of course, the family doctor didn't come along with them. And so I went with my dad to, you know, whoever he was seeing for his condition. And coming home, I couldn't talk, I couldn't say anything, but I was shocked. My thought that was going through my head was, my God, this doctor, there's nothing bad about him. This doctor does not care if my dad lives or dies. He is just the next piece of meat coming down the tray. Now, there was no malevolence. It was simply not knowing who my dad was as a person and not having the time or the bandwidth. And this is in the 70s. This is not now. But we're 45 years past that time. But my point being that in that shift from the personal, intangible aspect of being a physician, being a healer, to, okay, you're limited to 15 minutes or how long you're limited to in assessing the next individual coming down the assembly line. I mean, that has to be tremendously disheartening.
Well, it is. And I will say, I don't think that physicians don't care. I think that hasn't been lost, but it's impossible to do the things that your job says you need to do. You need to click all these boxes on the electronic medical record. Mm. And so a lot of times during a patient visit, the physician is looking at the computer screen, not at the eyes of the patient. Mm. And that's where the relationship has gotten lost. And it's not the physician's fault. It's not the provider's fault. It's the system that has overtaken medical care. So we now have a healthcare system, like I said before, it's for profit. It's not focused on making patients better, on building the patient-physician relationship. It's not focused on that anymore. It's focused on making a profit. And the people who are making these decisions, you never see. And so it's done autonomously. It's done in boardrooms because that's where their purpose is. And so it's a whole different scenario, unfortunately.
It's
quite sad, but it doesn't take away from the need for health care.
Well, what it is that the healthy and caring part has been eliminated, and it's about the mechanics. It's about the physical aspects of medicine rather than the intangibles that have been called, bedside manner is an innocuous term for it, but really, I think knowing your patient and having a sense of who they are. For even if I give them these things to do to change their lifestyle, you got to know, well, what are they going to do or not do? I can make a prescription for them to do this, but if I know they're not going to do that, I'm going to have to find something that will have an impact. That they will be easier for them to comply, and simply not knowing the patient, but simply knowing the treatment. There's a gap there.
And I think that is what has led to so much frustration with physicians nowadays, because they do still care. they do still want to do the right thing for their patient. They do still want to get to know their patient. But this administrative burden that has been placed on them by this system has been chipping away at that ability to do both.
Well, you know, it's so crazy in that, you know, when you're in medical school and all that time you spent and all that intense staying up all night and learning this, and then how is your time being spent? Your time is being spent, you know, punching keys on the computer, complying with these forms, and, you know, just as the menu ain't the food at the restaurant, the forms are not the patient and their well-being.
That's exactly true. That is exactly true. And I'm, you know, hoping people will, enough patients will realize that it is in their best interest that single payer Medicare for All would provide them exactly what they need. They will provide them the ability to have a relationship with their physician, and it will also provide them access to health care without a financial burden. And that is the key to get that point across, to be able to convince people that this will solve the problem here. Because one of the things that has happened is that, like you say, we're not able to talk to patients anymore. And it becomes more of a mechanical maneuver. And everybody loses.
Well, you know, we're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, we're going to actually talk about the specific issues in the African-American community that make the situation even more challenging. This is Steve Behrman. We'll be back with Dr. Susan Rogers when we return.
Free your mind with OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America. 200 food banks strong.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Susan Rogers. She's president of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program. Let's look a little bit more at the how this impacts the African American community and other communities that are poor and underserved. You know, even mainstream medical authorities are now agreeing that enhancing the immune system would improve diet, supplementing with vitamin C and vitamin D3 and zinc can help in the prevention of COVID, or at least in mitigating the symptoms. However, many inner city communities, getting even nutritious food is a challenge, let alone being able to afford supplements. So this seems to be a vexing issue, because there's a lot of people who have way more options and alternatives to handle these conditions, and you know, people who are poor don't. How do we deal with that, and what's the impact, do you see?
Well, you know, the devastating effects of COVID were just so predictable. When you think about what was the current economic economic and employment and all these other issues that were so negatively impacting the Black community. And so that when COVID hit, it really was, it shouldn't have been a surprise. And that knowing that so many in the Black community worked as essential workers, they were faced with no choice about what to do. They either had to go to work, get exposed to COVID and bring it home and then infect their families, or they could not go to work and then risk going broke, becoming homeless and hungry. So they didn't have a lot of choices that people with better economic means would have. And so it put the Black community just in an awful situation because it wasn't acknowledged. And part of the problem in this country is that poor people have been made invisible. Segregation created communities of which people have no contact with. There's no contact between these communities, and that segregation was condoned. It was allowed and legislated to be legal by the government, and all the structures that have been placed have created these communities without a way to achieve economic equity, to achieve educational equity, to achieve all the things in neighborhoods that allow people to function well, to develop, to grow, to prosper, and to be healthy. So it's one thing to say that vitamin D and zinc may help, but if you don't even have a grocery store that can provide you with fresh produce and meats, you're not going to be able to be healthy, regardless of what supplements you may be able to have access to. A lot of communities in poverty are described as fast food swamps. They are loaded with highly processed food, chips, pop, all of this fast food stuff, but they don't have good nutrition, so that people are growing up unhealthy. And what that's doing to the children in these communities, and studies have shown that children who grow up in poverty like this, they don't do well as well in school. They end up not being as functional. They end up not developing as well. And so their outlook of life is not going to be the same. So that this country, because of structural racism, has created an environment where poor people, especially Black people, cannot prosper. And one of the things we have to remember, too, why this impacts the Black community more, is that Black poverty is different from white poverty. If you look at areas like, I live in Chicago, if you look at the areas of what we call concentrated poverty, and that is a community where at least 30% of the community lives below the federal poverty level. So if you look at the communities in Chicago where you have white people living in a similar situation, it's less than 5%. So 35% of poor people in Chicago live in areas of concentrated poverty. That is surrounded by everybody else. Everybody else they're surrounded by is also poor. Whereas you look at white people, they're in communities where people aren't always so poor. So those communities still have good schools. Those communities still have grocery stores. Those communities still have parks. They have transportation. They have good schools. So growing up poor and white still allows you access to things that poor Black children do not have access to. And that is the structure that creates an environment where Black people are going to be more devastated by something like COVID. They're more devastated by the everyday bad things that happen in life. And then when you have a pandemic like COVID, it's even more devastating. So it's not a surprise that this has happened. And even if you look at, you know, what has happened with trying to get patients transferred during COVID, there was a big to-do about these hospitals in California that were not accepting transfers of poor patients from other hospitals that were overwhelmed to these wealthier hospitals. I mean, that's just atrocious. Now, a single payer would address that because everybody would be paid the same. It wouldn't be that wealthier patients would be chosen over poor patients, which is a choice that should never, ever have to be there. But that's the milieu that the Black community has been created for them. And it's through no fault of their own. Unfortunately, this country does a lot of victim blaming. People are obese because they just choose to eat chips. But if you live in a neighborhood where that's all there is, you know.
Right. You know, I just watched a documentary. It's just about to come out. Mark Gerson put together a documentary called The Reunited States of America. And in this documentary, this family from conservative family takes a trip across the country on in their RV, and they meet all kinds of people who they wouldn't meet otherwise. And one of the people they meet is a Black woman, and as they began talking with her, for the first time she was able to tell any white people about this, what happened to her at a hospital when she's waiting for her baby to be born. It was an emergency situation, and as she's waiting in the ER, because she was very low priority, her baby died. Her mm-hmm. baby died. And I'm sure that you can multiply this out over you know, thousands, if not millions, of different cases. And one of the things that came out in this movie, and I actually heard one of the guy in the movie say, and he said this with innocence. He didn't say this as like, you know, it was no prejudice or hatred. It was simply ignorance and innocence. He said, wow, I thought this race thing was already handled. And I think part of what happened, you know, through the George Floyd and Black Lives Matters movement this past summer, more people came to realize that there is a difference. And looking at my own experience, I was a minority kid. I was a white kid in a Black neighborhood. And that's a problem. That's a problem. However, that's not the same as being a Black kid in a white neighborhood. When I left that neighborhood, I was white. I continue to be white to this day. And I really started, in particular, my wife just picked up the DVD set Roots from the 1970s, from 40-something years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched all 12 episodes of Roots. And I have to tell you, you know, as much as I thought that I knew, it absolutely changed my perspective to recognize how different it is to be not uprooted, not just from your loved ones, but from your history, from your beingness, from your identity, your true identity, and then beaten, mistreated, et cetera, and then having that in your collective memory, in your DNA, and so on. And it was such a, you know, sobering, humbling, I would say, experience to remember that it's not the same as me being a white kid in a Black neighborhood, not at all the same. And what I learned was about being a white kid, I did not really learn, even though I had lots of friends, I did not really learn what it was like from their standpoint. I was too busy surviving myself. And looking at it now, I go, everybody should see that 12-hour series.
Yeah, but you had to survive against individual circumstances. Black children have to survive against a whole racist structure that places obstacles in their way. And you know, it's a different battle. The impact is different. And you know, even if you look at, you know, the inequities that persist, education doesn't even eliminate them. If you look at the same educational levels, the salary, the income, the job prospects are not the same for Blacks and whites with the same level of education. And even after, you know, people would say after President Obama was elected that we're post-racial. But obviously we weren't.
Not
he was not treated as if we were post-racial at all. But why does it take someone with all the accolades and positives like Obama to convince you? You know? And so people, you know, the structure, the valuation, Black people have been not valued, their lives have not been valued since the day they were first brought here, and they never have been valued. And one of the things that, you know, I have a real big issue with in this country is all of this discussion about democracy and the lack of democracy, you know, is not the issue here. It's the white supremacy. It's the structural racism. It's the devaluation of Black lives, because the systems and the policies have nothing to do with the lack of democracy. They have to do with the lack of equality. And until we can address equality, we can have a democracy that still has inequality.
What impact do you think the Black Lives Matters movement had, particularly this past summer? I know that there was a lot of, it just really seemed that in terms of the athletic community, I mean, I think finally white athletes were actually seeing their Black colleagues in a new way and recognizing, yes, they did grow up different than I did. I did not have to have, you know, what they were up against. Do you think it had an impact, and what kind of impact did it have?
Oh, it had a great impact. And I think part of the resistance to the Black Lives Matter movement was this assumption that anytime Black people get together, there's inherent violence. And that's what people feared about a group of Black people getting together demanding something. So even though, you know, people said about Colin Kaepernick, well, you should protest in another way. Well, what other way? I mean, he's protesting nonviolently, you know, following Dr. King's lead, and that wasn't good. And then Black Lives Matter, they're protesting nonviolently. But people still see violence as an undertone, even when there is none, because Black people are involved. And I think that one of the things that the Capitol showed was the stark difference in the reaction.
Absolutely.
And people talked about there's no way Black lives, you could have had 25 Black people there and they would have been arrested. You know, it's like the guy that, I'm blanking on his name, but he's been arrested and he's accused of killing those two Black Lives protesters.
Oh yeah, the kid,
you know,
in,
who was
Minnesota.
White.
Right,
yeah,
right,
yeah. And so it's self-defense, as if there's inherent violence whenever there's an interaction with Black people. That's part of the underlying tone of this country.
Well,
is that,
you know,
there's.
Yeah, I mean, that's been true. Again, in watching the Roots series, you just see how violence and domination and oppression. It's just endemic, and then, well, okay, so the slaves have been freed. It's simply a re-disenfranchising of these people who've been freed. So, you know, this is really an issue that it's long past time to be healed in this country. You know, I know Marianne Williamson had been talking about reparations and that sort of thing. There actually does have to be some kind of a reckoning and acknowledgement of this shadow piece.
Well, there never has been in this country. There's never been any acknowledgement that what they did was wrong. When you look at when were most of those statues and school namings and public buildings, most of those were done after the 1900s.
Absolutely.
You know, long after slavery ended, long after Reconstruction ended, you know, but people still touted it, and that's because the economies, both the North and the South, were dependent on each other. Whereas you look at the difference in Germany, there's not a single statue to Hitler. There's not a single Nazi flag or Nazi emblem anywhere in that country. However, there are memorials to the Jews that were killed. So they have acknowledged the wrong. This country has never acknowledged the wrong. And they are able to do that, the value of black lives will never be equitable. Because right now, the inequity is shown in the policies and the laws and the way people are treated by our democratic government.
this is what we're calling the upwising. As people wake up and wise up, we do have to have our own Nuremberg, and perhaps out of the violence that happened on January 6th and, the kinds of things that are still ongoing, it may be that becomes our reckoning. How many Confederate flags did you see being carried into the, I'm sure there were not false flags. I think those were real flags. Dr. Susan Rogers, I'm so happy to have had you on our show today on Wiki Politiki. I wish you the best in advocating for universal health care, and may it happen during our not just our lifetime, but during the next couple of years. Thank you so much.
I hope it happens soon. Thank you for asking me today.
Okay. Bye. This is Steve Berman, Wiki Politiki. We'll be back with you next week.